So the question was asked, can there ever be a unification of minhagim? Meaning, can we reach a point where all of Am Yisrael is doing the same minhag? And I want us to begin by seeing the different types of minhagim that exist, and then we'll move on from there, maybe to see part of the answer. Maybe. So, first of all, when we speak about minhagim, there are really different types of minhagim. We'll start with the one that we're most familiar with, which is Dvarim Mutarim Ve'Acherim Nagu Be'em Isur. Something which technically is mutter. There's no prohibition to do it. But there's a minhag that certain people have that they don't do it. So some people won't do work on the Erev Pesach in the morning. People have different minhagim about whether they will or won't do work then. There were places where they wouldn't let two brothers go to the mikveh together. Technically, there's no prohibition. There were places where they wouldn't sit on the benches that people would work on during the week on Shabbos because it looks like you're sitting down to do business. So there's no prohibition sitting on that bench, but they had that custom in that place. In other places, they didn't have that. So minhagim, the idea of minhag, is actually, in this realm, it is specific to a location. And usually, in order for us to respect the minhag, Tosfos writes, and the Mordechai, Hagos Mordechai writes, that the minhag has to be from a place where there were rabbis who oversaw the development of the minhag. Because minhag, Tosfos already writes, is not in our Tosfos, but the Hagos Mordechai, if I'm not mistaken, quotes from the Tosfos that minhag is the letters Gehinom. And that's people like to say that it's actually in their Shonim, that idea. So in order for a minhag to be a bona fide minhag that we respect, the minhag has to have been overseen by a community that has rabbis who ensure that the minhag is based. So we have the first type of minhag, which is what we're most familiar with, which is a minhag which you really, you look at the halacha, you say, that should be mutar, but our minhag is not that way. So dvarim amutarim, something that's mutar, v'achrim, someone other than yourself, nagu be'em isu, they treat it as prohibited. You're not allowed to treat that as permissible in front of them. You can't come along and tell them, hey guys, this is permissible. I know you don't do it, but it's permissible. So that's the lightest form of minhag. About that minhag, we have the idea that if you transfer, if let's say an Ashkenazi moves to live with Sfardim, so we all know that kitnios is mutter. We know that kitnios isn't chametz. Our minhag is we don't eat kitnios. But if I would move to Egypt, I'd be allowed to eat kitnios because I'm joining a community that treats it as mutar. Again, you come and tell me, but kitnios isn't chametz. I say, you're right. It's my minhag. So you could argue why it should be mutar. I don't argue with you it should be mutar, but that's my minhag.
And if it's so traveling around, you follow the nusach when you daven and so on.
Leave nusach for a minute, because that's... Let's assume nusach falls under that category.
Okay.
That if you would join a community in Yemen, you would join their nusach of tefillah. In that sense, it's true. It's a little bit more complex, but generally, yes. Generally, nusach would fall under that category, too. So if we're talking about minhag, we the idea of respecting a minhag is not that they're right, it should be prohibited. No, I can show you why halachically it's permissible. But that's the idea of minhag. That type of minhag, you could be matir neder. So if I have a minhag like that, technically I could go to a rabbi, and if he'll help me, if he'll see it right, I can convene a court, he'll convene a court of three people, we can do a tarat nedarim, and a person can actually change that minhag in many instances. Now let's quantify that just one second. Within that minhag, we also have that minhag when it's not just dvarim amutarim, it's dvarim amutarim, and there's a chashash isur. I have to suspect that if I'm going to leave that permissible, people will come to transgressing other things. So then we can have the rabbis institute a prohibition, or we can have a minhag to consider something prohibited, even though I know it's permissible, but there was a concern that I might come to do something prohibitive. Kitniyot, according to some opinions, falls under that category. And then, because kitniyot, according to some opinions, stem from a fear that people would have wheat kernels mixed in, like happens still today, whether it's prevalent enough or not prevalent enough, well, some people who are in the business say it is. Other people argue that it isn't. I for sure don't know. But there are definitely good sources that say it is prevalent enough. So I think the U.S. Department of Agriculture says it's prevalent, saying scientifically. But bottom line, there we have a question. Can you be matir neder? Because it's not just a custom which technically is permissible, and we have a custom. It's a custom which we treat as prohibited because it stems from the fear of transgressing a prohibition. So why did some people fear it and some people didn't? Let's say, it's a little bit more complex. Let's say we have the custom today not to marry a second wife. I'm just going to go to a third type of minhag, okay? Chaim Rabbeinu Gershom ended centuries ago. So some rabbis extended it, but that seems to either have ended or will end soon. So now I want to marry a second wife. So I'm going to go to the rabbi and say, I want to be matir neder, I want to go against the, I want to change my custom, I want to marry a second wife. I can't do that because the marriage was done with an understanding that I'd only marry one wife. So one of the challenges in minhag is to be able to see how far-reaching are the sources of the minhag and how far-reaching are the implications of the minhag. And that's not always obvious to the naked eye. We don't always know why a minhag was instituted. So there are jokes, there are funny stories people say about that. You know, the Hasidic dance where everyone would duck at one point, and that's because in the Rebbe's house there was a beam over there, so they'd always have to duck, so it became a minhag, that when they dance around, they duck over there, right? So there are funny stories like that, but there are also stories the other way, where they say, I don't know if it's true, that in the Ramah's town, the Gabbai would always tell a person good yomtiv the morning after his wife went to mikveh, because in Krakow it was freezing cold, and the women they had a very big yetzer hara not to go to mikveh, because it was real cold to go into the mikveh. And if they didn't know that the next morning the husband would find out if they cheated, so then they couldn't be trusted, because there was too much of a temptation to find to tell their husband they were going and actually go watch a movie, whatever. I'm saying, not a movie, they didn't have movies back then, but I'm saying, so there was a big temptation. So there was a custom that the Gabbai's wife knew was the one in the mikveh, and he would come and tell Mazel Tov, and this way the wife knew that the next morning the husband would find out if she didn't go. So that minhag, when the Rama first came, didn't understand why there was such a minhag there. Seems like a funny thing. No one should really know. It's immodest to talk about when a woman goes to the mikveh. So when you first looked at that minhag, you couldn't understand why it was that way. And that's why I'm saying minhagim are a little bit tricky, that we don't always know where the minhag came from. Why do we do that? The Gemara even brings stories where they didn't know. Rashi has a story. There are stories throughout the generations where they thought they knew one way, and then they realized, no, there was a really good reason for this minhag we didn't take into account. So that's the first type of minhag. Dvarim mutarim, v'acharim nagu b'hem isur. We said that breaks down to sometimes that's a minhag which is because we're worried about transgressing prohibition, and sometimes there can be other ramifications or other sources, but the general approach to that type of minhag would be, if it's not because we're concerned of transgressing a prohibition, that one could change. One could do a taras nedar. Then there's a second type of minhag, which we'll get to in a second. Yeah?
If it is...
But I'm sorry, we're skipping on him, and that's not fair. Yeah?
You said fathers and hatar nedarim. Can a guy do that even if his dad's there? No, don't get rid of the family minhag. We held on to this. We survived the Holocaust so we could hold on to the things we practice as a sir. And you just, you know, you have life easy and you want to just reject it like this? You can't do that. Would that have any weight?
So there's a concept in halacha that a parent can obligate their kids. We find by Yonadav ben Rechav. So if the father's smart, he can word it in a way that the kid is stuck. If he just says, you can't do that, and he indicates his displeasure, so I think out of Kibbut Avim, the kid should wait till the father's not around, but I don't think that would obligate him.
So if you said Beis Din is going to do the Taras Nedarim, are they going to ask this fellow, what exactly do you want to be matir, and is this the type of thing your parents are alive and sticking up for?
So that's, if I understand correctly, that's a machlokas. There's a response of Rav Shlomo Zalman that indicates, like you're saying, that
I didn't take a position.
I'm saying, so there's one place where Rav Shlomo Zalman is mashma that if it'll really irk one's parents, that we have to take that into account. And I don't remember who are the dissenting opinions. I'm not so sure that Rav Shlomo Zalman really meant that. When I read his tshuva, I read it more as an ethical thing, that Rav Shlomo Zalman was saying, you really shouldn't do that, slap your parents in the face. I didn't read it as, I read the line, I I once had this discussion with someone, and he argued that that's what Rosh Shlomo Zalman was saying, and I understood it as Rosh Shlomo Zalman was saying, it's not a nice thing to do, not that it's prohibited, not that the parents can really obligate you and say no. I'm not sure what Rosh Shlomo Zalman held on that.